with the federal problems, is Dan extra busy or not busy at all? Because I noticed Dan is not here.
Dan is not here because the only day that I could record was a Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
And his preferred day is Thursday just because of his schedule. And I didn't even ask him because I didn't think he would be that down with a weird old Japanese sci-fi movie. Maybe that's on me making assumptions. So if you're listening, Dan, sorry. And please tell me.
I think we're still
I got it wrong. I assume Charlie is keeping all of this.
Less editing, I guess, if you want me to. Hypothetically easier?
No, you still have to do all the editing.
Oh, well, okay.
Because anyway, we're in progress here at the Gobeski Wallace Report. My name's Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. Today we have three guests with us. We've got Doug Gobeski.
Hello!
Paul Wilcox.
Thanks for having me.
And Kevin Fredvogue.
Hey, excited to be here.
Someday one of you, whoever gets introduced first, is going to say hello. It's great to be here. Excited to you have me or whatever. And the other two aren't going to know what to do.
I still panic every time.
You've said that before, and I didn't do it this time in deference to my co-guests.
Not as chaotic.
We had solidarity in our lack of creativity.
Oh gosh. But it's mutually assured destruction. But
yeah, if I start that arms race 2 out of 3 times, I'm gonna be on the receiving end.
Have to start Jimmy Tacoing
says all the intros so fast that they become his intros.
He says his intro before I can say it. But we're here talking about the 23rd installment of our sci-fi shuffle. This time around, it's the 1956 Japanese film, Warning from Space. Adam, why did you pick this movie? Good question. Well, I'd like to say that it was something about having more foreign films in the shuffle and such. But the real reason is that I bought a copy of the Blu-ray used at Azia Records a while ago. And I was just waiting for the right opportunity to do it for the shuffle. I was going to do it the last time around, but then we ended up watching a different Japanese movie, and then I wanted to do Metropolis. So that's the story. Oh, thanks, Adam. Yeah, you're welcome.
So who were you talking to, Adam?
Talking to Adam.
Okay, and Adam, who were you talking to?
I'm talking to Adam.
Okay, I was just a little confused because only one of you was identifying the other.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That happens. It's a Pyron duplication thing.
Oh,
The transmutation device, machine, beam, whatever it was, didn't quite work out right?
Yeah, it's just, you get that amnesia.
Oh, yeah, I got you.
It took me way too long. I was like, where have I heard Pyra before?
Where have you heard Pyra before, Paul?
This movie, Warning from Space, when I watched it a few days ago. So it's not as fresh in my mind as it could have been.
Is that the first time you'd watched it?
Yes.
Okay. Because when I finally watched my Blu-ray copy, it was the first time I'd watched it.
Nice.
So I just want to get that out there.
I had never seen this either. I'd never heard of it. I had no idea what to expect.
Possibly you still haven't seen it.
This is true. I ended up watching the Pluto TV version, which I guess was a different version than what you all watched. It was the dubbed version, which I guess is an American television version. And it had a couple of weird little quirks to it. But I think ultimately...
And also based on what I saw when I looked at it to figure out what the heck you were talking about when you were in the text going like, hey, does this movie end weird? It appeared to be in 240p resolution, so...
It was pretty bad, So you can all tell me about the visuals.
You couldn't even tell that they'd inserted an opening scene by running one of the scenes backwards such that a rocket flies backwards into the space station.
That's correct.
Trail first.
And speaking of backwards scenes, the last scene of the movie is the transformation of the Pyron to a human, but backwards. So back
which
into
does
Pyron.
Not happen in the Japanese version.
And then the movie just stops, like dead stop. I was like, huh. But anyway, I think ultimately, like story-wise, I think it's pretty similar besides a couple of things like that.
Well, I guess we'll find out if this is another Spider-Man 2.1 situation.
So Kevin, how about you? Had you seen this before?
I sure hadn't, Charlie. Thanks for asking. I watched it for the first time two and a half hours ago or so while eating burritos.
Kind of burritos.
I made like a bean and rice dip maybe on Monday. So I just kind of repurposed that, threw some extra cheese and hot sauce in there. So bean burritos, I guess, is the answer to that. Doug, how about you? Had you seen this movie before?
No. In fact, today was my first time seeing this. I'm pretty certain I've never even caught bits and pieces of it on TV either.
Yeah, that's partly just because of the fact that this is a fairly obscure movie. In some ways, that seems to be just because there may not have been super high quality prints of it available. For instance, the American dub that Charlie watched, based on the 2 minutes I watched, looked like it had been dragged through a pond. But even the remastered version definitely has some picture issues. There's a lot of picture flicker going on. So it seems like this is a movie that perhaps is not as beloved as some other similar movies, contemporary like Godzilla. This is the first Japanese science fiction film to be made in color by the studio Daiei. January 1956 release. It's actually one of the earliest Japanese science fiction movies in general. Depending on who you ask, Japan has some history with science fiction, although in many regards it seems to tend more towards fantasy. But for instance, the oldest existing like large work in Japanese historical fiction is the tale of the bamboo cutter, where the princess Kaguya is said to be a princess from the moon.
I used to watch the Big Bird version of that as a kid over and over. If you guys don't know about that one,
we'll absolutely track it down. And
it's called Big Bird in Japan or something like that. And it's more, it's like kind of a, you know, a edutainment type thing. But there's also like, it's got the tale of Princess Kaguya in it.
So point of order, though, I don't think that just because something comes from the moon, it's science fiction.
No, that's a reasonable point, and that's why people rather debate on how much that counts as science fiction, because that's not really relevant to the actual tale. There starts to be some more literary science fiction in Japan as Western influences come in. And then Osamu Tezuka, the creator of Astro Boy, does some manga, and he has a trilogy of early science fiction stories, including Metropolis, that the 2001 animated movie is based on. But as far as science fiction movies go, Japan doesn't have a lot. It has a couple versions of The Invisible Man, basically, in the late 40s and very early 50s. And then the one that probably everyone knows, Godzilla. But it did have some imported American films. They had imported and seen The Day the Earth Stood Still. They'd seen The War of the Worlds, the George Pal version. And probably most pertinently for this movie, they had seen the movie When Worlds Collide, also from George Pal. But as far as Japanese movies goes, there's not a lot, science fiction-wise. And yeah, this is the first color feature. So all that is to say that some things that may look like very hoary cliches to us these days may be there partly just to familiarize the audience with these sorts of ideas, because they weren't as common in Japanese culture. This is a movie that does not appear to have been made with any eye towards international distribution, really. It got some play in France and Britain. In the United States, it was relegated to television. There was a company that dubbed the movie that did a number of dubs, and then they sold it as part of a syndication package starting in the 60s. You could see it fairly often in the 60s and 70s, and after that, it seems to have more or less disappeared from view in America, at least. But a couple of other things to say about the background. The Pirans themselves, the starfish people with the eye in the center, they are designed by Taro Okamoto, who is a very famous and well-known avant-garde artist from Japan. And one wonders if the DC people, DC Comics, had seen this, because the character of Starro, who appears a few years later in DC Comics, looks an awful lot like the Pirans, just blown up to a giant size, which is also, by the way, how many of the posters marketed the Pirans as towering over the helpless humans. And then the other thing to know is that the script is written by Hideo Oguni, who wrote such movies as Seven Samurai, Sanjuro, High and Low, I believe. A lot of Kurosawa. A lot of very well-known scripts and movies. And then he also wrote this.
So let's start at the beginning, as I know it. Enter in the middle of a song, halfway through the credits. I think like a minute later, we see the umbrella, which supposedly is the first shot of what you all saw.
Yes. So to be clear, the English version opens with a scene of the Pyrans establishing their intentions. This does not happen in the Japanese movie until probably a third of the way through, at least.
Oh, yeah. I honestly can't remember the order of things as they happened. I don't think ultimately it mattered.
Just like in general too much, in your life?
No, in the film. Like, I remember it was just so off-putting the way it just like abruptly started that kind of stuck with me. I was like thinking for a little while, am I watching an okay version of this?
And the answer was no.
No.
And you just kept going all the way to the end.
Well, I thought it'd be something interesting to talk about, if nothing else.
Don't let that gut feeling steer you away from being astray. So wait, what do you mean that it opened in the something about in the middle of a song? What?
Yeah, it very much felt like the first few seconds had been cut out. And it was like in the middle of the
based on what I saw, it was approximately the first 30 seconds of the credits were missing.
Oh, was it? Okay.
So you did not see the movie or any of the cast. I think it started with like the associate producer's credit or something.
It's such a weird version.
Yeah. And yeah, I definitely looked at this and I went, he sat through this whole thing and never once asked a question. Okay. Like, I was like, is this what all the versions are like? Like, I'm going on to Amazon and YouTube and stuff, and I'm like, no, they all have the proper version. He just picked the one.
The app was already on my television.
Charlie watching this movie on interdimensional cable from Rick and Morty. Yeah, because for me, the intro was basically, here's a red screen with people's names on it for an extended period of time as we go through the whole cast. And it definitely gave me, made me regret a little bit watching it with headphones on, because the sound quality, I mean, I realize it's 1956, but it wasn't really at modern standards, shall we say. A lot of hiss, too.
I mean, I might have noticed it, but I was watching. Yeah,
it's
the
headphones.
That's prevalent.
The problem.
I watched the
Google Play version, which I believe is the Aero Video version.
Oh, okay. So the same one.
Probably the weirdest thing I noticed was that the captions were not in the center of the screen, generally.
Yeah, there was definitely some hiss. Some of that, I think, is just from the 50s-ness of it. And I think some of it is just the fact that the existing masters that they have are just, as we've already seen and said, not in the greatest of shape.
When they had the singer as well, like when they introduced her and all of, you know, the band playing the music and stuff, I was like, oh, they did not do the best job of recording this, because it definitely was overwhelming the recording equipment. But, you know, I mean, these are just kind of minor quibbles.
From our point of view, Charlie, the movie opens with a nice domestic scene of people getting off the train and heading to the bar. We were introduced to one of our main characters, whose name I've already forgotten.
Dr. Something.
Yes, because this movie is an ensemble piece, it feels like, where characters come and go without any real, like, development.
Yeah, felt kind of gave me disaster movie vibes, you know. Yeah.
Oh, this is the astronomer. Oh, this is the physicist. This is the forensic scientist. I don't even know what that guy was doing.
So I think the background you gave is important, because I think you're right. I think a lot of the things we see in this movie, like the interaction between these characters, is how they're dealing with the discovering these aliens. It's stuff that we've seen in other things, and you know, it's trying to familiarize this audience, as you said, Adam. But at the same time, it just kind of feels a little bit like, I don't know. I think all the interpersonal stuff wasn't particularly interesting to me. Like, I was like, oh, let's just get to some aliens, you know? And I guess my version had them like right off the bat. But even so.
Yeah, our version doesn't even know there's aliens.
Right.
It takes a while.
Yeah, thought they were just monsters coming out of the sea at first.
Oh, yeah. One thing I forgot to mention is that in the United Kingdom, one of the titles this movie went under was The Mysterious Satellite.
Ah, even more withholding.
And one other thing to say is that Warning from Space, the American title, is the title that the American release chose. The more literal translation of the Japanese title is Spacemen Appear in Tokyo.
While I was watching it, I was like, wait a second, and had to Google it and just verify for myself that this is pre-Sputnik.
It is.
Oh,
which is,
wow.
It was very discombobulating because they were talking about artificial satellites, even though those weren't really a thing yet. And additionally, they were launching interplanetary missiles. And I also looked up, hey, what was the first intercontinental ballistic missile? And the answer was the missile that they used to launch Sputnik, which they, you know, launched that one like a month or two before they actually launched Sputnik. So August 57 would be like the earliest that you get the intercontinental ballistic missile.
Speaking of things like that, at a number of points during the movie, they referenced something called, I think, like the World Council.
Yeah, what? Yeah.
It is.
I assume they just meant the UN, right?
It is worth noting that this movie was released before Japan joined the United Nations.
Oh, wait, when did the United Nations start?
45, 46, something like that, post-World War II.
When did it get popular?
Well, I think part of the issue with Japan is they had to sort of rebuild.
Hmm.
And so is this set in the future then, the movie?
I don't know that it really makes it clear.
Yeah, I didn't really get that sense, but all these things we're talking about, like, oh, yeah.
They referenced the nuclear, I mean, that Japan had gotten hit by nuclear warheads. I know that doesn't make it the future or anything, but I don't know. I got the impression that it was a relatively recent event in the present of the movie. So I assumed
like
it
maybe
was
a decade
it was
prior.
Released. Yeah. I mean,
no. So there actually was a newspaper, and I did check a calendar to confirm, because it was like Wednesday, November 30th, 1955. And that
is true.
You know, November 30th, 1955 was indeed a Wednesday. So it wasn't like, you know, just some random thing, other than, you know, maybe it actually was just some random prop or something that they didn't really look too closely at. And another thing, so a large part of the plot revolves around element 101, urium, they call it, which those of us in the future know as Mendelevium, which had been first synthesized in 1955.
So I guess that gives you some idea of when the script was written, at least.
Okay, yeah, I guess.
Broke Doug.
So just to be clear, the script was written at some point, and they made a movie, and by the time they released it, we already had the element that they were talking about. It's not even one of the super heavy ones anyway. It's just, you know, regular heavy ones. But
it's super explosive, I hear.
Yeah, right.
Even molecules of it or whatever. I love that the aliens came to Earth mostly to warn about the planet that was about to crash into it, but was also like, oh, by the way, like that thing that you just happen to have open on your desk as I walk past, that's also going to kill you.
But I actually found that really strange, because they were like, no, that's terrible. And then later on, the plot hinges on the guy making it.
I didn't get, like, I checked how much time was left, and there were like 3 minutes left in the movie, and like nothing had been resolved. Like, why did the aliens not just take care of this themselves rather than wait until presumed billions of people have been displaced or killed in the storms that have occurred because a fiery planet is like 20 feet from Earth? And they're like, okay, you know what? Never mind. Just the thing that we said to ignore, like, let's, we just borrow that real quick. We don't have it written down. So
they do. Yeah, say, yeah. They do say that their race, the Pyrans, had long ago abandoned research into element 101.
But they immediately recognized it when written down on a piece of paper.
Yes, that was the thing, which for me was like, how did you recognize it instantly?
Well,
but you don't have the you can't make it yourself without that formula.
It's instantly. It's like how Charlie can recognize a scorpion despite having never seen one.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised that you all are treating these aliens like and thinking that they act like humans. I thought their behavior was sort of weird enough that like I wasn't questioning those things. I mean, for instance, you sent us a text about how the 2D woman, right?
Oh, that was a joke.
I know, but they have a picture of a woman.
Joke for Paul's enjoyment.
Like the anime.
We have to look like a human from Earth. And so let's just use this one. Let's not question at all who this person might be. And they picked like the most famous person ever.
Famous person ever.
Well, someone famous enough that it's going to be a problem, which I didn't have a problem with that. I'm like, they don't know. They're just problem solving on the fly.
So if we made this movie now, would she look like Sailor Moon or Hatsune Miku?
Man, I hope so.
I have really had no problem with that, but like just from a narrative perspective, like humanity was completely worthless for this entire movie. And then I don't know that it's exactly Deus Ex Machina, but it just felt like such a weird, like, oh, you know what? Never mind. We took care of it. Like there, it was just such an anticlimax. Like I was actually starting to get tense near the end of the movie because I thought like, oh, maybe everyone actually dies. Like maybe
right,
this,
I did
this
too.
Was like to see if humanity was going to be able to do it, and they could not do it. And the end. Like I kept expecting there to be a deeper meaning or message to things, and then at the very end, the aliens are just like, just kidding. We're just gonna fix this for you. Like
I'm just imagining conversations we didn't see between the aliens, like. Well, how hot can humans survive? Like, could it get a little bit hotter? I don't know. Let's see. We'll jump in at the last minute, but they could probably get a little bit hotter, right?
No, Charlie.
There are a lot of drowning children down there. They seem to have a lot, so...
They were trying to find Dr. Matsuda. Yeah. Is that his name?
That's true. That's true.
It is. He's the only one who had the formula because the woman tore it up.
Yeah, and they what did they miscalculate that all the world's nuclear weapons didn't work like they promised it would?
That was funny.
Yeah, so the moral of the movie...
They waited too long.
Aliens. Yeah.
The moral of the movie here, if I understand it, is that we need more nuclear weapons research into even more explosive weapons because the ones we have currently in 1956 just aren't going to be explosive and destructive enough. We need planet crackers, dang it.
If we want to save a different planet someday, yes, we do.
Sort of weird that the take-home message from this movie that was, as we have touched on, made in Japan was like, we need bigger weapons. Like even these super smart people who are warning us that it's a bad idea to use this, even those smart people are going to want these, like this power source for weapons by the end.
I think it was that just, you know, once we trick the whole Earth into throwing theirs away, then only Japan has them. I think that's the message.
Oh, that's fair. Oh.
Yeah, but it's too powerful. They can't even use it.
I mean, you
can't even use it against your neighbor. You're going to blow up the whole planet.
My expectations are way too high of a movie of this era. But like, there's even an interesting like, and they kind of touched on it that like some of the nations wanted to not use their weapons because then everyone else has weapons. But it was like three sentences, and then everyone decided to shoot them at the rogue planet anyway. Like, it just, I don't know. I didn't hate it or anything. Just I'm probably being a little too unfair to it, judging it maybe by slightly more modern standards. But I don't know, even by the standards of like old Japanese sci-fi I have seen, based more around alien invasions rather than this force of nature like Prince of Space or Invasion of the Neptune Men, both of which are movies where human beings, just like I just complained about here, really ended up pretty useless in the end, and it had to be the aliens that saved the day. At least the aliens were kind of part of the story, interacting with people, fighting the bad guys the entire time, as opposed to just bailing for like the back half of the movie before returning and fixing everything. I don't know.
So one thing to maybe make explicit, because I think this was kind of implicit in my history, but because there are so few science fiction Japanese films at this time, this is the first Japanese science fiction film, not only in color, but the first one to deal with any sort of visitors from another world in any form. So some of this may be just a side effect of that.
They didn't have the rule book yet for
exactly
for invasions.
They didn't have that American Cold War paranoia.
Yeah, which is like, right. What if they're good?
Yeah, they kind of things? Refreshing. Yeah.
Like I said, they had a couple. They had War of the Worlds, but they also had Day the Earth Stood Still. So, you know, those are polar opposites of each other. According to the commentary, select scene commentary I listened to by Stuart Galbraith IV, they had not received movies like It Came from Outer Space yet. So they had been exposed to the concept. It hadn't been a lot, and this was their first attempt at it. Which is partly, I think, why there's such emphasis towards the beginning about like the guy getting a photograph of the UFOs and stuff like that.
There are certain elements I think I can forgive knowing that. Like, I could see a producer being like, whoa, like, what's this alien bullshit? We need like a weird mobster who's trying to steal the formula from like for foreign countries. Let's work that into this. It helps a little.
And note how he had a foreign name.
George,
yeah,
devil. Oh yeah,
trying to secure nuclear weapons for outer heaven.
Well, and that's I was wondering if like, oh, is this like a weird, it's all a test for humanity, like as long as he doesn't give it up, like,
I did wonder that myself.
Yeah, really, like yeah. I had such lofty expectations and then it was just like nope, just kind of a dumbass trying to steal
this really is just a gangster spy.
Definitely not where my thoughts went. They beat this guy up and, like, tied him to a chair and just left him for literally days. And so my thought was, man, he probably shit his pants.
Okay, but talking about that scene, there's the moment where he, like, smashes the window and the gangster's like, unless you can fly, there's no escape. And then if you look two windows over, there's a fire escape.
You just broke the wrong window.
I definitely thought that was very funny.
Like, later on, he's looking at the window when he's trying to get out of the ropes. And I thought like, oh, okay. Like he's going to try to cut the ropes with the glass. And then he just kind of falls over instead. I don't know. Yeah. I wanted some human to do something of use.
You got to get to the glass, right? And if you fail at the first step.
Hey, the humans weren't completely useless. The windows broke in the observatory and they put barrels up. I don't quite understand how that was supposed to work, but
half of our heroes were just passing out from heat exhaustion. It was hard to root for the ? good guys.
So the girl near the beginning, there was some, the one who's visiting her uncle, like there's a conversation there about her potentially getting married. And then there's like a little bit more about that later. And as best as I can tell, they never did anything with that thread.
Yeah, the impression I got was that she had eyes for the young scientist guy. But yeah, it never went anywhere.
Like, I was kind of frustrated by that.
But I think Paul kind of had it right. Like, this in many ways is a disaster movie that just happens to involve beings from space trying to help.
Mm-hmm. That was actually what I kind of appreciated about it, was that I didn't really know where the movie was going at the beginning. I just assumed it was going to be like an alien invasion thing. And then when they have the planet actually approaching the Earth, I was like, oh, I like this. This is kind of interesting. Of course, it reminded me of Melancholia, but in a way that a completely unrelated movie can, because it has a planet hurtling towards Earth. But
yeah, but it's like how the first is about like weird visitations and aliens popping up out of the water and stuff. And then the middle part's about like this disguised person, only slightly let down by the fact that the pirates have a whole conversation with, I will admit, I appreciate it in the Japanese version. I don't think this is true in the English version, but in the Japanese version, they're just making like wah, 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 sounds.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Subtitled on the left and right of the screen.
Yeah.
That was my favorite scene by like a lot.
Is it because the aliens were body shaming all the humans and talking like it was just such a weird conversation?
It was a great It was like, they have a lump in their face? That's
are they weird. More beautiful than us? It was just weird.
I really enjoyed that. But yeah,
good weird. Other than, yes, I agree. Good weird.
But other than the fact that, like, yeah, so we get that scene telling us that, like, oh, the aliens are good, actually. Like, there's that whole middle part with the woman where it's like, oh, she must be an alien because she can jump really high and walk through doors and stuff.
Yeah.
And actually, I watched that scene where she gets mobbed by the schoolgirls like 3 or 4 times to figure out how they did it. I never quite got it all the way. Like, clearly the guy moves in front to block, and then she has to go somewhere. And you can see her for a split second walking across outside one of the doors, but I'm still not sure
how. Through a doggy door, maybe?
Because I was like, oh, well, maybe there's no glass in the door, but then, like, the door opens and you can see the reflection in the glass. So I was impressed, basically. That's what I'm saying. But yeah, so there's that middle part, and then it turns into a disaster film at the end.
Did they cover why she was making people figure out that she was an alien before doing her mission of telling them why they were there to begin with? Like, why did she pretend to be a human for so long? They may have said it. Like, did I miss that?
I think she's trying to establish their trust because they were freaked out by the starfish, their actual appearance.
Nope, that's fair.
I like the tennis scene because the guy who was playing against her was just kind of like nonchalant, like, all right, well, I'm done playing tennis. I'm going to head inside. And then later it's like, she just jumped 10 feet. I was trying to play it cool, but.
Exactly. He's the suave one.
I know.
Yeah, Kevin, I don't know why she decided to wait so long before revealing herself by just walking through doors.
I think
I think that was because she just didn't understand doors. The scene in which all of the Pyrans are talking, like they're having their big conference, and then like it transitions to them with the transmutation machine. At the end of the scene with the conference, they all just sort of disappear. Oh, so I think they move around by just teleporting, and they don't get the idea of a door.
I just like how the guy asked her, like, how did you get in here? And she was like, through the door. So I'm like, technically true.
In universe, that logic makes sense, but I do think it's kind of funny that the filmmakers were like, we need to give them a superpower. That superpower is they don't need to use doors. They just walk up to the door, then disappear, reappear on the other side.
We could understand the comedic potential of doing the opposite, right? Like, a human gets an alien costume and goes to the aliens world and just starts trying to do stuff. And of course they don't understand how it all works.
Yeah, but that's because humans don't have interstellar travel.
Yeah, that's true.
Our planet for 3,000 years, if I remember correctly.
A lot of door history.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thought, because at some point somebody had to invent the door.
I mean, they've got tennis. I mean,
It was probably earlier than 3,000 years ago, but still, you know, cavemen.
Who invented the door?
Did cavemen have doors?
This movie's making us ask the important questions.
I'm sure people were like leaning stuff against, you know, like, like the, just things they've, you know, there's like the rock in front of the door, you know, maybe like you. Or you
ancient
just kind of lean a bunch of
people. The earliest known history of doors with tomb paintings from about 4,000 years ago depicting them. Often single or double leaves of a single piece of wood.
Huh.
Herron of Alexandria is credited with inventing the first automatic door. I don't know what that means.
Wait, not hero? H-E-R-O?
It says H-E-R-O-N, but it's also, it's also Gemini, so it could very well be wrong.
And I mean, maybe I'm just misremembering, but
Von Connell invented the revolving door.
Aww. Who invented the what kind of cool doors are there? Iris-shaped doors?
Hero is also known as Herron, so it's the same person.
Okay.
Sorry, we're getting sidetracked.
Yeah.
So this is what this movie does, man.
Speaking of like, you know, kind of like a plot thing that'll start and not really go anywhere, did this kind of give like condensed serial vibes to anyone? Like, it was almost like someone like wrote this out to be like a multi-episode kind of thing, and then was like, what if we just crammed it all together? Like, it kind of felt like that to me.
It does split into thirds. I'll be honest, pretty well. Yeah,
Yeah, I'll be honest. When you said condensed cereal, I thought of it in terms of condensed milk and like cereal with a C and was very, very confused.
I also thought that I still didn't understand what the hell you were talking about. That makes so much more sense.
And then you said like, Jim, and I was like, oh, he means with an S. Okay.
No, I still didn't get the verbiage, but I understood what he was going for.
I see what you mean, though. Yeah, it has like that three-act structure, and each act's pretty different, and characters kind of come and go.
All of them are threads that you could, you could have a full resolved side story of, you know.
And one of the things I learned from the commentary is that the early Japanese science fiction movies, the Invisible Man ones in particular, and I think one called Rainbow Man, Stuart Galbraith IV said that those had a very serialized quality to them as well. So this could also just be part of that, maybe. Because I guess they had the Republic era serials maybe in Japan. Or maybe I misunderstood what he was saying.
Are any of the Stuart Galbraiths famous?
Stuart Galbraith IV has written a number of books about Japanese film, including at least one that our dad has. So I remember him looking through it at one point, the Chambara, whatever the Chambara book is.
Okay.
So he's a reasonably well-known, decently well-regarded Japanese expert, cinema expert.
Film buff?
Film buff, yeah. Okay. I mean, he's no Donald Ritchie, but who is?
Who's Donald Ritchie?
He's probably the best known Japanese film buff critic.
Okay.
Like even Paul.
Like in the West, you mean?
He's probably instrumental in bringing Japanese cinema to the Western world, or at least to America.
Okay.
Right, Paul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hold on. I'm looking at the wrong guy online. Okay.
One thing I thought, I guess, was, I'm not going to say it was like, oh, this is interesting, but it was a kind of an interesting contrast between like the somewhat limited sci-fi movies I've seen of that era in general, like more Western. Like, you know, we touched on there was sort of like a building up of a love aspect in the movie that just didn't really come into fruition. And a lot of the focus was kind of on the elder generation, whereas like this exact movie where it made in America, the alien and some character would have fallen in love. And like that would have been a huge focus of the movie. It was kind of interesting to see a movie from this same era that kind of focused on the elders instead of the young lovers. Like I was very much not expecting that when they were setting everything up.
Have you seen The Day the Earth Stood Still?
It's been a very long time, but yes.
Okay. Because that is a movie where the human woman not exactly falls in love with the alien, but pretty much falls in love with the alien.
Even of the movies we've watched, like Teenagers from Outer Space, I mean, that happened. And
that's true.
That was the general plot in The Day the Earth Stood Still. Like it's a very, I don't know, I guess I just thought it was a trope in most movies in that era, but now I guess I'm potentially seeing it as more of a Americans demand a sappy love story element.
I mean, it's right in the title, like Teenagers from Outer Space, whereas the alternate title of this could be Old Men Heed the Warning from Space.
Old men sweating profusely.
For what it's worth, Teenagers from Outer Space, don't forget, is 1959, so it's a little later than this.
Sure. I mean, still the same era, right? Wait, when did
Isn't it black and white?
Yeah.
Teenagers from Outer Space.
Yeah.
But, I mean, some of the sci-fi movies I'm thinking of that came from Japan were definitely still in black and white, so I think it was kind of adopted slowly throughout the industry. Okay.
Yes, right? Like, think how long the Godzilla movies are in black and white.
And I guess to compliment the movie on that, I'm not saying like every single visual was amazing. There was some miniature work that I thought looked a little silly, but like the color, especially if that was like the first color movie in Japan, I thought it was pretty okay.
It's not the first color movie, it's the first science fiction.
Oh, excuse me. But still, presumably a very early, you know, color.
Early. They had done some experiments pre-war with I think it was like the equivalent of like two strip Technicolor. And then post-war, they'd start to do a little bit more, but obviously it was very expensive and stuff. So,
well, if not the literal technology, then I guess the visual aesthetics or whatever of, you know, like when the planet, the rogue planet got close enough and everything just kind of took out that red tinge to it. Like there were some visuals that I very much enjoyed.
The shade of blue used for the aliens, I thought was particularly nice to look at. Yeah. I realize that's an odd comment, but I stand by it.
The aliens themselves for their, like, goo that they left behind.
The residue.
Yeah.
You're going to have to tell me, too, just because the version I saw was such horrible quality. Did they boil fish alive in this movie? It looked to me like they were real fish that were swimming around. And then suddenly weren't moving anymore. But they could have been really good. Like,
I don't know. About that too.
that whole section, I was like, I'm not going to think too hard. This was a long time ago, and
those fish would be dead anyway now.
Yeah,
maybe give them the benefit of the doubt in that stock footage. I don't know.
Yeah, that's it's. I was like,
I did appreciate that the dog was just kind of like lying down and very clearly not dead. The bird
probably was doing like a dirt bath thing, I assume, I hope.
Although the dog did kind of stumble, I was like, did they get the dog drunk, maybe? That would probably be fine. Just once. You know, it's not a what is it, Milo and Otis situation.
No.
I don't understand that reference.
That was a, I believe, Japanese-made movie. Starring a real life cat and dog.
So kind of like Homeward Bound?
Yeah, kind of like that. Apparently there were some, I believe there were some animal practices that would not have happened now or even then, maybe in, you know, different country. I don't know.
I've got enough. Like I have exactly the correct amount of background that I require.
The things that ruin, you know, as someone who watched Milo Notice, like, you know, dozens of times as a kid, and then, you know, there's always that smug person when you grow up who like wants to ruin your childhood by telling you how many.
So, is there anything that anyone wanted to talk about that we haven't talked about yet? I know the movie kind of lends itself to hopping around, so we've been doing that. However,
there was one comment from somebody, I don't remember who it was or at what point in the movie, but says something to the effect that the astronomer guy is tired from staring into the telescope all day, and it's during the day, which implies that he's just been doing stargazing during the day.
There's definitely a shot where he is, I think it's when they're trying to visualize the rogue planet, where he is just staring in the middle of the day, and then they show time passing until it's finally night, and then he does find it, which, yeah, they think that's what the astronomers do, I guess.
I kind of loved all the scenes in the observatory, like it's just like a giant tube with like one little eyepiece and like a bunch of guys stand around like, let me see, take a look at this. And you know, I don't know how actual optical huge telescopes worked back then. Maybe that's exactly what it was like, but it's kind of funny. Just
the entire press corps there, not bothering politicians, but bothering the 2 to 3 scientists that are in charge of all of science for Japan.
Hey, come on. Just give us an answer, man. Like, I don't know yet.
I enjoyed the international telephone operator guy who had to actually use a switch like it was a walkie-talkie to toggle like when he was speaking and when he was listening.
I kind of loved all of those scenes. And pretty good English, too.
I was gonna, you know? It was jarring.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, he suddenly perfectly switched over to English. Charlie, what was your dubbed version like there? Did his voice change at all, or was it redubbed over?
No, I think it was just all English.
Yeah, but was it the original Japanese person speaking
I
English?
Didn't notice
did they
the difference
redub
at that time,
his English
yeah. I didn't
with
notice, yeah.
The new English person?
I would assume it would be a redub just so that the voice matched.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder if they redubbed the other people, like the observatory in India.
And maybe we already talked about this, but I don't recall, Charlie. But when you're on the spaceship with the aliens, are the subtitles in Japanese still on the sides of the screen? screen whenever they're speaking?
No.
Or...
No.
No, they have zoomed in the image.
Yep.
To get around
it. Classic crop. Like, cause that,
and because
Americans don't want to see no goddamn Japanese characters in their movies.
Because the subtitles appear back and forth on left and right side of the screen. I haven't seen it. Maybe Charlie confirmed. The effect apparently is that it pans and scans backwards and forwards like someone at a tennis match.
Oh, yeah.
Just shift as the picture just shifts left and right. So, yeah, ultimately, what did you think of Spacemen Appear in Tokyo, a.k.a. Warning from Space? Did you enjoy it? Is it a movie you would recommend to others? What do you say, Doug?
I didn't hate it. I moderately enjoyed it, although I did find a lot of the plotting frustrating. Yeah, I'm not really sure there's many people I could recommend this to, because it feels like kind of a niche audience kind of thing, like film buffs, international cinema, science fiction, like history, that kind of stuff. I think it's kind of a curio in that regard, but like just as a work of art, it just doesn't quite all work together. So there's a lot to like about it, but I think the whole is less than the sum of its parts. And for the counterpoint, Adam, what did you think?
This is the greatest movie that was ever made by anyone ever. No, I think I generally probably agree with that. I definitely found the movie charming. That said, there were definitely moments that I felt the movie kind of dragged a bit, which is not a great thing when your movie's less than 90 minutes long. But there's a charm to this movie and to these sort of 50s movies that was still present here, and I liked it. And I liked the design of the Pyrens and some of the effects I really enjoyed, even if they were like simple, like the woman getting mobbed by the schoolgirls and going disappearing through the door, like that was well done. I would recommend this movie to people who are interested in like 50s sci-fi movies. I think this is an interesting example, although this would not be my first movie to watch from that era. I'd probably get a few under the belt before I turn to this one. But overall, I did enjoy it. Charming, I think, probably for me is the best way to sum this movie up. How about you, Kevin?
So Doug took a lot of the words right out of my mouth. You know, as I was thinking what I was going to be saying here, he was saying what I was thinking, that it's interesting to watch this, you know, for its historical value. But as a work of art, even by the standards of its time, there's a lot to, you know, bash it for. I'm not upset I watched it by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean, for me, I mean,
better
a lot
than
of
Mad God.
There you go. I will not be demanding an apology for this. It was more,
Quick question.
Sure, of course.
If the Pyrens had not saved the world in the last 3 minutes, would that change your opinion?
I would have had such incredible respect for that downer of an ending, especially from a movie in this like era, that I really do think it would have flavored my opinion of the movie much more differently. Even, you know, it would reframe the whole kind of stereotypical beginning of a sci-fi movie first third or two thirds, that like the punchline is no, actually everyone dies because humanity was not good enough to deal with this problem.
I needed to ask, because right up until the Pyrens save the day, Deus Ex Machina style, I was thinking to myself, wow, Adam managed to choose a movie that's more nihilistic than Mad God.
No.
Yeah.
Just extended
that would
scenes
only be...
of people dying.
This movie's too old and non-Russian for that.
They could have just done the ending where everyone dies except the children, and they're roaming the wasteland.
The aliens could have saved the children at the end. I would have. Yeah. I would have.
The kids go to space.
Yep.
Oh yeah, the Pyrens did say that their planet was basically like Earth.
That's true. They were even building up to it. Anyway,
shame they couldn't bring the parents along.
I enjoyed the movie for what it was, I suppose, but I definitely enjoyed it from more of a, this would be a fun Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie than a, I value this as a work of art movie.
Yeah, I was actually slightly surprised that there's not a Mystery Science
Theater
3000 of this.
If ever we have a season 14, we'll see. Let's see. Paul, what did you think of this movie?
Yeah, I don't think I have too different a take from anyone else. Probably Adam sort of captured it for me. Like, I did enjoy it in its own right. It was pretty, you know, there was like a lot of charm to it. I liked the alien design, and I just could have gone for more alien looking aliens, you know, I mean, like more time with the aliens in their true form. But, you know, it had some of the sort of campy sci-fi fun aspect to it, but kind of, yeah, wrapped up in that disaster movie ensemble cast, which sort of, I don't know, made it a little bit of a different thing. I would recommend it for someone who, yeah, is interested in the history surrounding it, really. But yeah, I agree that there's other things you might want to watch first, but I enjoyed it.
So I love having the context that Adam gave at the beginning about this movie, because the first half of the movie, I think it's a little bit boring because it has so many of those tropes that we are so used to now. But I think at the time it wouldn't have been quite as much of a slog, like, oh, you know, these aliens are coming and they introduce themselves to the humans and the humans don't like them. And so they transform one of them into a human and then they're trying to infiltrate us. So, but I think it's pretty impressive from that aspect how well they do it, knowing the history of sci-fi and Japanese movies at this point. But the stuff I really actually enjoyed watching was the second half of the movie with the planet hurtling towards Earth and Earth's attempts to stop it and the heat coming down on the planet and everybody passing out and things like that. It's like, oh, this is all kind of original and interesting. And I haven't really seen as much of this, especially the alien design I thought was cool too, because it's the sort of thing that now people would be like, oh no, that's lame. We're not going to make our aliens look like giant stars. But I'm like, oh, this is cool. It's back when they would actually try something like that. So I don't know. Those are the parts of the movie I enjoyed. I thought it was worth watching. But again, as everyone else said, I'm not really sure who I'd recommend this to. It's a fun one to talk about now. Wow. I don't think so.
So dismissive.
Of the movie. Celeste. Yeah. Oh, man. I'd have to explain so much as it was happening. But maybe it'd be her favorite movie. I don't know.
It's true. You don't know. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for watching Warning from Space with me. I appreciate it. Normally, this is the point where I'd pull up wheelofnames.com, but we only have one name, and I've already done that bit. So we're just going to go straight to Paul.
All right.
Paul, what is your pick for our next movie on the Sci-Fi Shuffle?
I wish I had more of a surprise, because I've said the name of the movie before, but I would like to watch 1985's Brazil.
Oh,
yay.
It's been one I've been wanting to watch for a while and looking for an opportunity to do it, and you know, seems like a good one to make everyone else watch. It's kind of long, but it's not the core. So,
we're not watching the studio cut.
Wait, hold on. There's different cuts of this.
There are three different cuts.
Oh, okay. Well, which one's the one that would make sense to watch then?
The one that would make the most sense to watch is probably the 142 final cut, according to Terry Gilliam. That is, appears to be available through Criterion. The Universal Pictures version is missing 10 minutes. And then there's a TV edit that is the studio cut that is 94 minutes long that I may watch just to,
as you've seen,
I've never actually watched it. I've seen Brazil, but I've never actually sat down and watched the Love Conquers All cut, as it's referred to.
Do I need to buy this as part of the Criterion sale in order to get the correct version?
How long did you say the good one is?
142 minutes is
okay. So it's the one, like, if I were to get this on Google, like, it's 2 hours and 22 minutes. So I assume it's more readily available than just
okay.
Yeah.
If it's Criterion, you might be able to get it on Canopy if you do that. Hmm. Maybe not, though. They don't have everything.
Well, as we record,
as we've been through before, Canopy very much depends on who you're getting Canopy through.
Precisely, but might be worth a shot.
Also, Canopy is immoral.
Is it better that you don't use it, or should you use it?
As we record, and not as we release, it'll be too late by that point, but the Criterion sale is currently happening at Barnes & Noble if you'd like a nice shiny copy. They just released, like, 4 or 5 months ago, the 4K version.
Ooh. Paul. Well, I've already got one, so thank you, Adam.
So thanks, everyone. Brazil sounds exciting. Be nice to watch I'm not going to say that. I was going to say it'd be nice to watch a good movie, but then I remembered Brazil and how it can be polarizing. So
I hope it is.
I don't want to bias anybody.
I hope it's very polarizing. We're at our best when we're polarized. Yeah. Us, not broadly. Yeah.
This podcast, you mean. But yeah, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Sci-Fi Shuffle as part of the Gobeski Wallace Report. I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. And especially a thanks to our three guests, Paul Wilcox.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Fredvoke.
Hey, it's been fun.
And Doug Gobeski.
It was a pleasure.
So there's still got to be one left. They didn't steal
it. Was that pause because you didn't know which one had been set?
Intro and outro.
I had to think about it and decided that It Was a Pleasure was different enough that it counted as not repeating what Kevin said.
And we all know that there's other things we could say too, right? Like you just say like
what?
Yep.
There are three entries and three exit statements, and that's all there is.
Yeah.
Never give me enough time to wait to think about what to say.
And if you say something stupid, then we know you're not going to give us a second try. Like, that's valid.
That's fair. Hey, thanks for coming along on that wacky adventure with us. You can see more of it on Facebook and Twitter.
And it says we have a website, www.gobeskiwallacereport.com, with more zany antics. Is this really what you wanted me to say?
I think that's the best reading we're going to get, so.
Fun for the whole family, including Grandma.
And Grandpa.
Oh, it's down at the bottom. And Grandpa.
You always forget Grandpa. Let's do it again.
I'm not really sure who that is.
Yeah,
I don't know how to explain Dillon is anymore.
Is that an actor?
Yeah.
Matt Dillon in general or like a specific movie?
No, just Matt Dillon.
Okay, sure.
What kind of things he...
What would I recognize this person from?
Crash, yeah. Wild Things, There's Something About Mary.
Which Crash?
The bad one.
Oh.
And he's one of these like pretty boy actors who I just feel like you haven't heard anything about for a while. Although apparently he was in Asteroid City, which I haven't seen yet.
Oh, yeah, he was. I forgot about that. You should see that.
Was he in anything that I would have recognized?
Anything I would have seen?
It's in Wayward Pines.
Herbie Fully Loaded.
The Outsiders.
Wait, what's The Outsiders?
Isn't it the one based on a Stephen King novel?
No, it's S.E. Hinton.
It's
got like Tom Cruise and all them in it.
Oh.
They're like. It's like a coming of age thug, punk movie. Punk's the wrong word. Punk in the old sense. Greasers,
No. Okay, so.
The sort of thing they might have shown you in school, basically.
So, like, literally nothing I would have ever seen.
NC Crash?
Still scrolling through.
No.
You, me, and Dupree?
No.
Herbie Fully Loaded?
Did that have Lindsay Lohan?
Yes.
She was hot back then, but no. I think I caught like a few minutes of it on TV once.
Go ahead and check Lindsay Lohan's age at the time.
That's like the first thing. <in the day. laughs> Let's get him.
She was 19 years old. Wait, can I do math?
Yeah.
Yes, 19 years old.
Wow, she was born. I'm
yes,
barely...
she was, Paul.
I mean, we don't know when it was filmed. She may or may not be in the clear.
Yeah, she could have been created with a transmutation machine.
That's
from
that's
a Pyren.
You're right. All right, I'm back. What was the question? Or is it too late?
Did you notice some hiss?
Mm-hmm. I realized that I said I was back, and then immediately stuck a dumpling in my mouth. It's not a small dumpling. It's a big boy.
You don't just gulp your soul. Let your stomach do the work.
It's not an oyster.
Yeah, you got to use your passive systems, Adam.
I don't need to taste any of the inside.
All the rocks I've eaten.